the gas!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fucksters? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my show. It's my podcast. Folks, big stuff today. Primary guest, Drew Friedman, cartoonist, artist, life changer for me. First guest, we got a short interview today with somebody most of you know. He's in a band. But before I talk about that specifically, I do have to admit that I've gotten perhaps a little arrogant or maybe insensitive, or maybe I'm just sticking by my guns. I'm not sure, but I'll try to explain to you. I'll explain the story to you. So I got an opportunity to interview somebody. This is a big guest. Okay, it's a big guest. And the opportunity was, look, you know, you can have him for 10 minutes and it's got to be pretty specific. And, you know, he doesn't really like getting personal. You know, it's a big thing. He wants to do the podcast. Now, I guess I should tell you, this guest is Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger. Have a nice 10-minute chat about the new tour, 15-city tour that they just announced. The Rolling Stones are doing a tour. They're also re-releasing Sticky Fingers on May 26th. This is what's going on for the Rolling Stones. So someone thought that it would be great to have him on the show, and then I talked to their main publicist, and she thought it would be great to have her show, and then I'm like, well, look, you know, I said this, and I got to cop to it. I got to own it, because it's fucking ridiculous. So I'm like, well, you know, I usually do an hour interview, and you know, that's sort of the format of the show. It's like an hour interview. This woman, Fran, was like, I know what you do, and we love what you do, and Mick, listen to what you do, but that's not what we're doing. And I'm like, yeah, I know, and, you know, and I'd love to talk to Keith for an hour if Mick can't do it. Keith would be great for an hour. She's like, I appreciate that, and I'm not ruling out that possibility in the future, but that's not happening now. What we thought is we'd have, you know, maybe Mick and, you know, Keith and maybe Ronnie, on your show for 10 minutes leading up to the tour. I'm like, well, you know, it's not what the show is. So let me talk to my producer and partner, business partner, Brendan McDonald, and let me get back to you on this. Because, yeah, I'd really like to do an hour if that's possible. And I was like, oh, well, where are they exactly? And she's like, I don't know where they're going to be. And, you know, we'll see what happens, where they're going to be. And I'm like, all right, because I could come to them and be like, well, no, we're not really doing that. But it's not what we're doing. And I'm like, all right, well, you know what? It's not what I do. So let me just check with my producer. So I call up Brendan. And rightfully so, he says, what the fuck is wrong with you? Mick Jagger wants to talk to you on the phone. Who cares what about or for how long? I mean, it's Mick Jagger. You talk about the Stones constantly. Really, if you look at the arc of the 550 or 80 or whatever episodes, they come up. I got a poster of Mick Jagger. I got the Gimme Shelter poster right here. My first guitar was a Telecaster once I got enough money to buy a guitar because Keith played a Telecaster. I used to stick my cigarette in the top of the guitar like Keith. You know, I used to sing along with Mick. I knew, you know, I can do the Mick finger shake. I listened to the Rolling Stones for the first time on a school bus when I was in eighth grade. My buddy Eric Tipman brought a Panasonic tape recorder, and his dad had Exile on Main Street. And he held that tape recorder up to that speaker, and he recorded several of the songs from Exile on Main Street, one of them being Sweet Virginia, there being a skip at a certain point in that song. And I awaited that skip every time I heard that song for at least two decades. It's past now, because I no longer remember where the skip was. Midnight Rambler changed my life. It's the Rolling Stones, all right? So Brendan's like, shut the fuck up, man. Just talk to Mick Jagger. Who cares how long it goes on? What's wrong? Talk to Mick Jagger. And I'm like, holy fuck, you're right, dude. What am I thinking? Jesus. So Mick Jagger's going to call me. And I wanted to, you know, I couldn't believe it. Now once I'd said like, yeah, and it got all set up, you know, I was like excited. I was like, okay, I can't believe I'm going to talk to Mick Jagger. And it got me emotional because it's an important person in my life, Mick Jagger. The Rolling Stones, Keith Richards, Charlie Watt, Bill Wyman, Ronnie Wood. They're important to me. So now I'm nervous and I'm excited and I'm freaking out. And I'm like, who? I want to share this experience with somebody, you know? So I was like, Dean Del Rey's the dude. Dean Del Rey, you know, he worked for them kind of. He should be here to, you know, with me. And he should, like, if he wants to, he should put some headphones on and enjoy this experience with me. Texted him. I'm like, dude, I'm gonna talk to Jagger for like 10 minutes. Do you want to be part of this? And he's like, hold on, maybe, hold on. Let me see if I can look at that text exchange. You want to come over and listen on the cans during the call? He goes, hell yeah, when? And I go, between 12:15 and 12:45, come over at noon. He goes, fuck yes, I am there, man. Kick ass. Thank you. And then he came over. So you'll hear it unfold momentarily. Me and Dean Del Rey leading up to the Mick Jagger call, then a conversation with me and Mick Jagger, and then me and Dean Del Rey trying to keep our shit together post Mick Jagger call. All right, so now let's go to me and Dean waiting for Mick Jagger to call the garage. I'm nervous, dude. I'm going to talk to Mick Jagger.
It's insane, man. It doesn't get any bigger than that.
No, but I only got like 10 minutes.
Yeah, but you know, I know that's weird because you're like, what do I ask? What do I ask? You got to...
Well, you want to connect with him. You don't want to just be like, I don't know if he's sitting there with a bunch of he's going back to back doing a phoner junket.
Yeah.
I don't fucking know. Yeah. I don't know if I'm the only call on the docket or if he's like, you know, who am I talking to now?
Yeah. Who's this again?
Yeah.
All right, let it rip.
Oh, this is the fellow in his garage. In his garage.
I mean, all those years you love the Stones, you have a million things you want to ask him.
Kind of, but like I'm more astounded that I'm going to talk to him. Yeah. Like I don't even know, what do you really ask him? You just want to say like, what's up?
Yeah. How about Altamont?
Yeah. There's part of me that wants to ask him that.
What's your favorite Stones record?
Oh, that's a good
right?
I think like, you know, more so than not, I go like Beggar's Banquet, I go back to a lot.
Right.
I mean, you know, and I like, I've been listening to the real old stuff lately.
Oh yeah. I'm not down with that stuff. The Brian Jones era.
Yeah. All that shit. Like it's really, some of it's great. Yeah. Like some of it's like straight up blues stuff. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
And it's a real clean sound. And I'll play some of that for you when we go back, like Out of Our Heads and what is it? December's Children. What day's the tour start, dude?
Oh, I forget.
Man, I'm not ready, man. I'm not ready. May 24th, San Diego.
There you go.
He's
calling the garage. You got to think when you started this podcast.
Mick Jagger. Calling the garage.
Calling the garage, dude. When you started the podcast, you didn't think that Jagger was going to call the garage, right?
No.
At all.
No. Why would I think that?
You know, you're just doing something that you want to do.
I feel like I'm waiting for a chick to go. I keep checking to make sure the phone's on the receiver, like old-timey. You know what
I mean?
Yeah,
like, yeah.
Is the phone working? Should I double check it? See if there's a dial tone? This is nuts. We're just sitting around waiting for fucking Mick Jagger to call. You know, and I don't, you know, people are like, Mick Jagger, so what? Fuck you.
Oh, no. Whoever says that is out of their mind.
I don't know if anyone's ever said it, but you know, sometimes you think like, are the Stones, does anyone care about the Stones? Who cares if anyone cares? Fucking Mick Jagger.
Yeah. Yeah, no one. There's only like five guys that have done what he has done, you know, still playing music. He's doing football fields, man, and baseball parks.
The greatest rock and roll band in the world.
Like not one, two, not five songs, you know, hundred songs that are played on radio every day.
Now I'm starting to think like, did I give him the wrong fucking phone number?
Oh, that's the worst. Right?
Well, I guess so. Whatever, man. You know, it's like if it doesn't happen.
I hear you.
What am I going to do? So now we're in a deficit. We're in overtime.
It's going to happen.
Now it's just going to be sad. It's going to be me and you like slowly getting disappointed. Minute by minute. I guess not happen. Then we'll go back in like, let's go listen to Sticky Fingers.
Yeah, that's like a sad day on York Street. That's our record.
Oh, no. What? No, it's my other phone.
Unbelievable.
Hello? Hello? Yeah. Good. How's it going? Oh, really? Another promo call? Oh, yeah. Like, when are you thinking? Well, you just want me to sit here, or do you want to give me a little window again? Well, I mean, it's just, well, look, I'm around. I'm just saying that, like, you know, I've been sitting here just waiting for a half hour looking at my phone. So if you're telling me I should keep doing that for another hour, I can. But if you can tell me, like, maybe like another half hour window, like if you want to try, if you think he can do it between 1:15 and 1:45, what do you think of that? Okay, so that's 1:30 and 2 here. Okay, deal. Let me know if there's a problem. I'll come back out here at 1:30 and we'll wait it out. Thank you. Bye.
Well, we know it's happening.
I got nothing. Now we get... Yeah, I checked. He got cut. Did you hear me, though?
Yeah.
He's caught up in another call, another promo call.
Dude, you are so Marin. It's hilarious. You know what I mean? Oh, really? I'm number 38? Yeah, okay. Well, I'm just out here in the garage.
Yeah, we'll go get in my phone.
I could have a grilled cheese sandwich right now, but no, I'm out here.
Let's take a break.
Okay. It's so fucking funny. Oh, my God.
Hello?
Hello?
Mick.
Hey, Mark.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm thrilled to talk to you. I'm going out of my mind. I'm sitting here. I'm like, oh, my God, is it going to happen? And there you are.
I'm sorry I'm late. I got the times wrong. I had a whole bunch of interviews, and I started late. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, it's no problem. We're just hanging out here in the garage waiting for you to call.
I'm so sorry. I just realized I got the times. I was started like half an hour late on everything.
No, it's great. So, it's great. I'm thrilled to talk to you. How you feeling?
Good. I'm feeling good.
Where are you calling from?
The West Indies.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Is it nice down there?
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great. Are you at the beach or something?
Not on the beach, but I'm near the beach.
Oh, that's sweet. So I'm psyched to talk to you. Is this the first time you've been on a podcast, or you never or have you before?
I think I've been on podcasts before.
Oh,
but
right.
I'm very pleased to be on yours.
Good. So you're re-releasing Sticky Fingers. Now, how much of did you spend any time with the record when they were remastering it or anything?
Oh yeah, I remastered them. I was there for the remastering.
What was it like to listen to that stuff again like that?
It's great. I really like the album. It's a really good album.
Oh, it's a great album. But I mean, when you sit and listen to those songs, do you go back in your mind to where it was recorded and what? Didn't you do that down at Muscle Shoals?
A bit of it.
Yeah,
like with three tracks in Muscle Shoals and the rest in London.
And when you hear those songs, do they trigger stuff? Do you get emotional about them, or do you have some distance from them?
Well, I mean, I sing them a lot, you know, now. So it's not like I'm listening to them for the first time.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, you know, so as a song, it's like, it's now for me, it's not like I haven't heard it for like 100 years. I mean, some songs you don't do, and when you listen to them, you think, wow, that takes me back. But, you know, when you play Wild Horses like a couple of months ago, it's not quite the same.
Well, when was the last time you played like Sister Morphine or Moonlight Mile?
We played it on stage not for a long, about 10 years ago, I should think, the last time we played that. Yeah, I haven't played that for a while.
It'd be hard. Would you think it'd be hard to get your head back into that one?
No, I get into it. I could get into that.
In terms of the tour, so you guys are going to be playing just the classics. What's the plan?
I don't know yet. You know, we're in rehearsal. I've got, you know, we'll make a bit of a mixture. We'll play like well-known songs. We'll play a couple. We always try and find a song that we've never done before. A couple of songs we've never done. We might feature a few songs from Sticky Fingers, more unusual one, maybe like the one you mentioned, maybe a couple of others. So it'll be a mixed bag, you know. It won't be just all like. Hopefully, it won't be just by the numbers, you know.
Sure, man. And do you get excited? Like, do you have any ideas of some of the songs that you haven't played in years that you might want to play?
Well, I'm gonna see. I'm gonna see in the rehearsals. I always go through a long list, and then we try them, and they say, that's not gonna work. Or that sounds like it's got possibilities. And, you know, we might feature some of the less well-known songs from Sticky Fingers because I think, you know, that'd be good.
That'd be amazing because I heard a rumor that you guys are just going to play that whole album right through.
Well, you know, the thing about it is that but that might work and it might not work. So, you know, it's got quite a few slow songs on it.
Yeah. But don't you think people would be oh my God, they're playing the entire record? Don't you think that
maybe it'll work, you know? You've got to see.
Yeah.
Maybe it's going to work good.
So when you decide, like, if you have an older song that you guys are just, you know, playing around with to see if you can play it, what determines whether or not you can do it or not? What makes you say, like, nah, it's not going to work?
You can just tell when you rehearse it.
Oh, really?
You know, if it's just, yeah. You can just tell if it works, you know, if it doesn't work.
Right, right, just by the feel of it.
Yeah, just by the feel, and if it really rocks or, you know, has some emotive thing to it, then you can really tell, and then, you know when it's not working.
Right, and how are you and Keith getting along?
Pretty good. I saw him the other day. He's pretty good.
Yeah.
Are you going to speak to him on this podcast?
I think so. Is Mick Taylor going to play with you guys again?
No, I don't think. He's not going to play on this tour.
No,
it's just going to be, it's just going to be us. We had a great time with him. I really enjoyed it, and we did a load of gigs. We went all around the world, and you know, we started off in London. It was going to be just one show in London, and you know, went all around the world together. But this is like another beginning of another tour. So, you know, so I don't think he's coming on this.
So, do you have any special guests in mind that might play with you?
Yeah, we'll see about special guests. You know, we did a lot of special guests on our last American tour, and it was a lot of fun. And so, you know, I think that kind of works, or maybe, you know, we should do something different. I like doing guests, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes the guests, you know, come up with amazing things. Sometimes it's, you know, it works out differently than you think, but it's, it's always fun.
What made you laugh? What exactly were you thinking when you said that?
Well, that sometimes the guests want to do different songs than you've imagined, and you know, you always want to be kind, and you know, you always want to be, you know, they're giving of their time, so you want to go along with it, and sometimes that really works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's I've had great experiences with it, because like we had special guests from all kinds of types of music, you know, it wasn't just like rock music.
Uh-huh.
Special guests, you know, and all age groups and all kinds, you know, so we had a really good time with that, and it, you never quite know what's going to happen, so I like the sort of unknown part of that.
Yeah. Do you ever miss Bill Wyman up there on stage when you're up there?
Oh yeah, I miss his dancing. But I managed to get. I see Bill quite often in London. He's a very sweet guy, and but you know,
yeah,
it was a long time. It's a long time ago that he left the band. Now, you know, it's years. I don't know how many years. It seems a long time.
Well, the last time I saw you live was in 1981 at Madison Square Garden.
Whoa, that's a long time. You must come, but more recent, more you know, come again.
Definitely, I definitely want to come again. It was such an amazing experience for me. Because I was, you know, we'd gotten our tickets through a lottery. And I remember at the time, I don't know if you remember, I think that James Brown was supposed to open for you, but something happened and Screaming Jay Hawkins.
That was in the Garden, and then he canceled.
Yeah, and Screaming Jay Hawkins opened.
That's right, but that's a pretty amazing opening act.
It was a trip, man. I mean, he was up
totally
there.
Totally mad.
Yeah, he was up there with his voodoo stick all alone. It was crazy.
Yeah. Really crazy.
So you remember?
But you've got to come more than once every 30 years.
I know, Mick. I'm gonna. I just.
So you're gonna come. So you're gonna. You should give me a call. You should book the tickets. Come with your friends, and we'll make a special place for you.
Really?
And come and enjoy yourself.
I'm gonna. I will definitely take you up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I would die. Like I tell you, man.
In Los Angeles?
I am. Yeah. And I love you guys.
You come to San Diego.
I will. You just don't. It's like I've loved you guys all my life. And, you know, when I knew I was going to talk to you, I had no idea, you know, what that was going to feel like for me. I'm sitting here. I've got a post. I got a huge poster right here in the garage. I got a bunch of stuff on the wall. And there's a huge a poster for the reissue of the Gimme Shelter movie with your face. So I see your face every day. And me and my buddy Dean Del Rey were just in the house listening to Stones music. It's crazy, man. I'm a huge fan.
So I look forward to seeing you there.
Well, Mick, it was great. It was a real honor to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Dude.
Oh man, that was fucking amazing, man.
You were like your tears.
I know I had tears because it's like I get choked up because the guy is so nice and real and alive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's so alive. He's like, hey, Mark, how are you? I'm in the West Indies. And you're just like.
I wanted to keep him on the phone.
I was losing my mind. And he was so nice, man. And I worked for the band, you know. But you don't talk to the band. Like, that's like a conversation he has with people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That you just think like, God, man. What a great dude.
Yeah.
How great was he?
Great, dude. I can't believe it. Like, did you see what happened, though? Right after.
We were leaving.
I know. Right after the chick says to call in an hour.
We're leaving.
We're leaving the room.
I couldn't believe it. We almost missed that, dude. I kept thinking
that.
That
was crazy. And I started fangirling out at the end. He's trying to get off the phone. I'm like, oh, just.
But still, man, at least he knows he didn't just call. And he invited you and your friends, which I'm your friend, to San Diego, man.
It sounded like they were kind of planning on doing the whole state.
I know, right? He's like, yeah. Maybe. I mean, there's a lot of slow songs, but I don't know why I'm trying to sound like him.
You know, I think maybe I can make that show.
Come on, dude. We got to go. Oh, how crazy was that?
I can't even believe it.
I can't either, dude, because we were walking out of the garage, and it's like, boo, your little landline.
I know.
And then he's like, no one told him, I'll call in an hour.
No.
You could tell.
He's in the West Indies. No, yeah. They just thought he was.
No one told him. That was insane. And we would have missed that. Yeah, that was.
I wonder if he's on the phone right now. It's like, I didn't like him
at all. Nah, he's not like that. He was genuine, like, cool, fun. He was laughing and stuff.
Okay, man. Well, thanks for hanging out.
It's so crazy. We had these headphones on. It was like he was right here.
I know. I look over at you. You're welling up. Dude.
I know. I couldn't believe it because I was just like, wow, man.
What's happening?
That guy is just a legend
Mick
to me.
Mick Jagger. Oh, yeah, man.
You know what I mean?
It was beautiful.
Oh,
it's beautiful.
Man. Ah.
All right, dude.
God damn it.
So that was insane. Was that insane? Dean and I went into the house after that and just sat on the couch, sort of numb. And we played Can't You Hear Me Knockin' off the original master recording of Sticky Fingers, the album, the vinyl, louder than I've played anything on my stereo. And then we played the non-live version of Midnight Rambler, loud, louder than I've played anything. And we sat there, two grown-ass men, slowly rocking our heads. And occasionally I would jump up and play a little air guitar or break into a bit of air drumming with some singing. We both did some singing. And after it was done, it was just, you know, he looked at me and said, dude, you just talked to Mick Jagger. I'm like, God damn, it's fucking crazy. Drew Friedman, the master. Master caricature artist, master cartoonist, master artist. Drew Friedman, who changed my life, I think the first time with his art in a book that he put together with his brother, Josh Allen Friedman. It was called Any Similarities to Persons Living or Dead is Purely Coincidental. Drew did the art. I think Josh, I think they both did a little of the writing, but mostly Josh did the writing. And it's just the type of satire. There's something about the way he captures show business personalities primarily with just there's a slight darkness to it. There's a slight, you know, it's not a rawness, but there's something haunting about the way he caricatures people. And then he did another book with his brother called Warts and All, which were also disturbing, but beautiful. And then there's the old Jewish comedians from Fantagraphics. Fantagraphics is a great press, a great comic press. You should go check out Fantagraphics anyways. at Fantagraphics.com. But let's get back to Drew Friedman. The old Jewish comedians are just pictures. They're just portraits of old Jewish comedians. And there's old Jewish comedians, and there's more old Jewish comedians, and there's even more old Jewish comedians. And these are spectacular books. It's sort of specific, but it's fucking amazing, man. It's fucking amazing the way he captures them. There's something about there's something almost demonic and beautiful about the way he captures show business person. There's a vulnerability there, but there's a darkness there. It's hard for me to even explain. He did The Fun Never Stops. He did Too Soon, Famous and Infamous Faces, 1995 to 2010. He's probably just a part of that. The point being that Drew Friedman is a master at the caricature art and at cartooning, and I just love him. I've always loved his work. And he's got a new book out now called Heroes of the Comics. It's available from Fantagraphics. It's got a foreword by Al Jaffe, another cartoonist who changed my fucking life. Al Jaffe, if any of you are old enough to sort of grow up with Mad Magazine, Al Jaffe was the fucking best. You can also check out all his work. He does a lot of, there's a lot of posters available at drewfriedman.net. He's done amazing portraits of, John Lennon, Frank Zappa, Frank Sinatra, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. I mean, they're just, for some reason, his sensibility and his subject matter just completely locks up with my sensibility. And the most glorious thing that happened was he did a portrait of me. And I haven't used it with anything yet, and I'm about to get it framed. And it's just, it's one of the, I honestly, folks, between Drew Friedman doing a portrait of me and me talking to Mick Jagger today, these are high points. This is bucket list shit. So it was a real pleasure for me to talk to Drew Friedman. The first book of yours that I got was, Any Similarities to Persons, Women, Does Purely Coincidental. And I'm glad they reissued it, because I don't even think I have my original paperback copy got so beat up because it was so mind-blowing to me. And I'm not even sure I completely understand why, but it was haunting and it had an effect on me for my life. Somehow it made sense of something that seemed to be lurking in my being since the beginning. And I'm not sure what it is. And then when you do all these other books about the old Jewish comics, I'm like, there it is again. There's something equally as disturbing and haunting about these characters as they are funny. I mean, I don't know where it comes from. Where do you find it?
I guess I've always had an obsession for things that nobody else is obsessed by.
That's it?
Basically, that's it. Nobody else gave a shit about this stuff, but I did for some reason.
Well, let's figure out what the reason is. So where'd you grow up? New York, right?
I grew up, New York, Long Island. First 12 years of my life, Long Island, then Manhattan. I was moved to Manhattan when I was 12.
Why'd you move?
I think my parents got bored with Long Island finally. They hated Glen Cove, and then they hated Great Neck.
Yeah.
And then we finally made the plunge and moved to Manhattan.
But your father was a writer.
Yeah, and he still is, Bruce J. Friedman. And, he was working in Manhattan, first as a magazine editor at this company called Magazine Management, where Stanley worked at the next table to him. But he was also writing his own books and plays and short stories, and for the theater as well.
Well, he's a very respected guy. He's one of the great dark wizards of the 70s, that generation, like Heller and Vonnegut and the satirists that, kind of wrote funny but kind of dark stuff.
And those guys were his friends, too.
Right.
The guys I grew up with who were his pals were Mario Puzo and Terry Southern and Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut.
Wait, so you're a kid. You're 11. How old's your brother?
My older brother Josh is 2 years older than me,
and he wrote the Tales of Times Square.
He wrote that book, and he wrote a lot of the material in the first book, Persons Living or Dead. And we collaborated on comic strips early on in the 80s.
So you're growing up, and you have a sister too?
No, we have a younger brother Kip, and I have a younger sister Molly. But we didn't grow up with her; she came a little later.
Right, of a second marriage thing.
Yeah.
So all right, so you're growing up in the 70s, in the late 60s. And, who could be at the house at any given time?
Well, those writers I named and
Terry Southern.
Terry Southern was one of his best pals, and Jules Pfeiffer was his friend. He had all these writer friends, but the guys who most impressed me were the cartoonists.
Right.
That he was friends with Jules Pfeiffer. That blew my mind, and Maurice Sendak. And later he got to meet people like Harvey Kurtzman. Those are the guys that impressed me. Those were my heroes. So
you didn't like Terry Southern, not an entertaining gentleman?
I took him for granted. It was great. It was great to have him around and see him in the house and
drinking.
Those guys. Yeah. Well, yeah, I didn't, I was too young to notice that kind of thing at the time. But I was friends with their sons.
Right.
I was friends with Terry Southern's son, Niall.
He still?
And We're in touch. Yeah, Niall's is making a movie about his son, his father, Terry, now, actually.
Finally.
Well, actually, he's been working on it, for the last 15 years. So,
I think I heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
It's
a lifelong project, I think. But, you know, it's at
some point. Do that, man.
Yeah, I have no plans to make one about my dad, but I guess I'm...
maybe just a long comic.
I haven't thought about that. Yeah, it would be more in the lines of a comic strip.
I had that guy, Denny Tedesco, whose father was in the Wrecking Crew, the studio musicians out here in L.A.
Yeah.
And he'd been working on this documentary for like 15 or 20 years. And they made Tommy Tedesco's his father. And he finally got distribution.
Wow.
It came together.
Wow. Well, I know Niall's film is going to be great when it finally happens. I've seen some footage, and I've talked to Niall about doing the poster for it, possibly.
Yeah.
So when it happens, I'm sure it'll be terrific.
So when you were a kid, but you were part of this world that was fairly, a very specific and kind of insulated world of groovy New York intellectuals and writers and stuff.
I guess I was there, and I kind of grew up at Elaine's, which is my dad's hangout.
So you went to Elaine's. You were in a booth at Elaine's growing up,
basically. But I didn't like it. I didn't like it. It was great to meet Al Pacino and Frank Sinatra and George Plimpton and all those guys that were at the tables and stuff. But I finally took it for granted. I want to be back in my bedroom with my guinea pig and my comic books and Mad magazines and Monster magazines and TV.
Yeah,
I wanted to just be in front of my TV. I didn't want to go to school or camp. I just wanted to watch TV. I just wanted to watch The Three Stooges.
On Channel 11?
Yeah, Channel 11, Channel 5, Channel 9, WOR. Channel 11 was WPIX. That had Joe Bolton and Jack McCarthy, those gods.
Yeah.
And Soupy Sales was on Channel 5, Metro Media.
So you remember Soupy Sales show when it was first on?
Oh, yeah. I remember Soupy telling the kids to, go take money off their parents. I remember it? I didn't do it, but I remember it. And I respected him for it, and I love the fact that they suspended him for 2 weeks and then brought him back. And I remember all that specifically.
You know his kids? You know Hunt and Tony?
I know all about them. I haven't met them, though.
Oh, but you know some of those musicians around. So growing up in New York, that must have been exciting, right?
It was, but again, I took it for granted. I had my own little world with the stuff I was obsessed with.
Were you a loner?
I was a weird little, I wasn't. In fact, I was, I always had lots of friends and stuff, and popular in school. I was a class clown.
Yeah.
I have no respect for class clowns. It's too easy. The audience is built in, It's like, you don't win. You don't earn that audience. I came to learn that later, but I was always popular, but I just wanted to be in my room.
You were hard on yourself about being class clown?
I thought about it later on. I said, that's nothing to brag about, being class clown. It's like people who say, I was the class clown. That's that sucks.
Did you ever have any aspirations to performing?
Yeah, I did actually, but I was also kind of shy when I was younger. It was I was always obsessed with drawing. If you talk to people who knew me back when I was a kid in school, I was always bent over the desk drawing. And that wasn't always a good thing because I was drawing my teachers naked, doing horrible things all over the desk. Because I knew then I wanted to be a Mad magazine contributor. That was my goal. I wanted to be one of the idiots.
So you read Mad before when it was small, when it was comic book form?
I got them later on in the paperback. But I was born in 58 and Mad became the magazine in 55.
Because that had a profound impact on me too when I first started reading it. But I think I was just, you're a little older than me, but I can't remember the first ones I read. But my grandmother's neighbor had a stack of them. Like Al Jaffe always was the guy to me.
He's terrific.
I loved him, it's amazing what a profound influence it has on your life, isn't it?
Of course, it had an influence on me, but also I wanted to be part of it. It wasn't just I loved it; I wanted to be in it, and that was my obsession, to be a Mad contributor.
Sure.
And I finally did at age 35. That came true.
Yeah.
But that was my goal when I was a little kid, to work for Mad, do work for Topps Bubblegum, like Wacky Packs and Ugly Stickers and stuff. That all came true. But also, I wanted to be a National Lampoon, and that happened. So, I guess I'm lucky because my childhood goals came to pass.
And so you're done.
Basically. But I was just obsessed with drawing all the time, bent over my desk drawing at all times. So, but I knew I'm not fit for anything else.
Right.
But what I do. So I knew that from an early age. I've never had a job in my life.
So, well, what do you think because when I think about Mad, I guess it gave me, because your subject matter is fairly specific and very unique. And I have to assume it's something a little more interesting than just doing something that no one else is doing. Because Mad Magazine, The Three Stooges, and watching Channel 11, those black and white TV shows, and you seem to have a mild obsession with Thor. And Joe Franklin.
Yeah.
And there's a freak show element to it. And I just remember the first time that I was a kid and I saw that lobby card for Freaks. Before I even saw the movie, I saw that when I was 8 or 9. And it was this portal into something I couldn't even figure out or understand. This humanity that was vulnerable and creepy and sympathetic and everything just was loaded up in there. Did you feel that something was did you feel like a... Like, it's not morbid. I don't even know what I'm trying to get at.
No, really. Gendo was like, you know, the people that nobody else gave a shit about. I think as far as Tor, I just saw the potential in him. Tor Johnson,
yeah,
who was the big zombie who roamed around in Plan 9 from outer space and
yeah,
could hardly speak, the big ex-wrestler. But I just saw the potential in him as a comic book character, as a guy in comics, because he had the white eyes like Dondi and Little Orphan Annie. So that was already there.
Yeah.
And just to have him, like, you know, just to, those films that he made were horrible, like Plan 9. But the footage of him is beautiful
in
Vampire roaming around the graveyard. So I just wanted to transfer that to comic form, which is, you know.
So that's the way your brain was sort of wired.
Yeah,
is that, you know, you
early
saw
on.
How people will fit into comics.
Yeah, I just thought he had so much potential as a comic star. You know, but, I saw that.
On the cover of the Any Similarity, is that Shemp is on the cover? Who's on the cover?
Well, Shemp is another guy because he's always everybody's least favorite stooge. Shemp Howard.
So you're like, that's your guy.
I don't even know if he's my favorite. I love Curly Howard. To me, he's like, he's a god. He's like from another planet almost.
Right.
You know, Curly. So insanely funny. Yeah. It's like, you know, and acting like a dog and rolling around on the ground. He's like, but I love all the Howard brothers, but there's something about Shemp because he looks like a real guy, I think. I figured it out years later. He looks like a guy I would see at bar mitzvahs and seders and stuff. Crazy uncles.
Exactly.
He didn't look like a comedian, although, you know, he did in a way, but he looked like just one of those crazy Jewish guys that I would say like a couple times a year.
Character.
He reminded me of that.
Yeah.
He was accessible.
Right.
Yeah. Where Larry was like sort of the, he was the guy in between.
Yeah.
He was like the audience's surrogate. You know, you could like always identify with Larry. He was just like there in the middle, even though he didn't know why he was there.
But,
and Mo, of course, was so angry at all. And that was so great.
Yeah.
Of course, and still is. Just watching him on YouTube, the clips of him just so angry about, you know.
Yeah. And everything.
Like, yeah. And he's just as stupid as the others, but he's just, you know, angry and in charge somehow. Somebody elected him to be in charge and he knew it. And I don't know. But there's something about Shemp too, and the greasy hair and parted in the middle,
right?
And he looked like a gentleman. He was so ugly, and he was voted ugliest man in Hollywood too. But I think I see beauty in ugliness. Always thought Boris Karloff was beautiful as Frankenstein monster.
Yeah,
and Shemp Howard to me is a thing of beauty.
Well, I think that's it. And that was it. You see beauty in ugliness.
That's it, and
I think that's what sort of confronts people when you look at your work, because it's so detailed and slightly there's a slight caricature to it. But you know, you're sort of like, you know, acne, bumps, pimples.
That's right.
You know, so everyone seems to be a little wet.
Right. There's a lot of moisture going on. People who smile too much. I pick up on all that stuff, but it's like... the people, like, nobody else would, you know, my dad said Drew always noticed the people nobody else would notice, like elevator men and the guys who sell newspapers. And it's true. I would, like, you know, spend extra attention absorbing those guys.
Do you sit there and, like, do you have that moment where you're like, what is their life like? Because, like, it seems like some in Any Similarity, and we'll go through the other books, like, you created a life for Joe Franklin. In a way.
Well, yeah. You know, with the
sitting
piece,
in an undershirt or something. I can't remember now.
Piece I did with Josh, which was his life story. We did some horrible things in that piece about he's coming out of his mother's vagina at the first panel.
Looking like he does now.
Right. Basically the same head. And, you know, horrible things are happening.
Yeah.
But, you know, Joe chose to sue me finally. He sued me for $40 million. And it was over a basically innocuous comic strip about him shrinking.
Uh-huh.
And that was the thing. He's very touchy about his height.
Uh-huh.
It was called The Incredible Shrinking Joe Franklin. The piece is in the first book as well. But Joe sued over that.
And that's what was worth $40 million?
Well, that was a reasonable sum, which I've always said. I had about $10 in the bank at the time. But he sued for $40, and it was finally dismissed. He also sued Nash Lampoon because it ran in heavy metal.
You really pissed Joe Franklin off.
That got to him, yeah. The fact that I went after his height.
So it's no good with you two.
No, that was like, you know, he sued Uncle Floyd for $35 million. He sued me for $40
million. Why did he sue Uncle Floyd?
He sued him. Uncle Floyd did the Joe Frankfurter show. He's like, he put on a big head and like did Joe Frankfurter, you know.
Right. You know who I had in here?
Who's that?
Marty Allen. Marty Allen, he's 95. He wanted to do the show.
Did he take off his wig when he sat down?
He didn't have a wig anymore.
Oh, really?
It's just sort of a weird thing going on.
When he performs in Vegas, he lives in Vegas. I think he has like a Kathy Lee Gifford co-host.
It's his wife.
Oh, okay.
It's his wife.
That's right.
It's crazy.
When Steve Rossi, the way they broke up with Alan and Rossi broke up, he got Slappy White
to be his.
Yeah, so it was like Rossi and White.
Is that what he did?
Yeah, he got Slappy White brief. So it was like a black and white team.
But Marty Allen coming over, he's walking up the hill. He's got a walker. There's two people that are with him, and we're like, "You need any help?" He's like, "No, hello there,
hello there." Nothing. What was he promoting? Even like,
I don't know why it happened. Uh-huh. I think somebody who works for him said it'd be nice. You know, they knew I did Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
So they're like, maybe Marty Allen. And I never really thought about it. And I had to like kind of go through the fact that it was a fairly substantial career he had.
Well, yeah, of course. He was big as Martin and Lewis in the 60s.
But they'd kind of replaced them in a way.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Once they kind of, I guess, broke up.
Yeah.
They were the guys.
That's right. Well,
but
in the 60s.
Between me and you, I'd never ever in my life, it was sort of endearing in some sad way that, you know, like he has to use the bathroom. He's 95. And then they leave, and he had pissed all over the fucking floor.
Did you clean up after him?
I cleaned, it was the first time.
I would go look at that piss if it was still there.
Yeah, I wish I had it for you.
I would take a photo of it.
I would have taken Marty Allen's pee.
Marty Allen's piss.
Yeah, I cleaned up after Marty. The first time I cleaned up after a guest. And I have to, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt that he didn't just piss on it on purpose.
Wow. You know, I've had people piss on my toilet too over the years.
On the floor,
in my apartment.
Everywhere.
I had Dan Aykroyd come up to my apartment once with my dad. They were working on a movie. It became a horrible movie, Dr. Detroit. But he came up and used my bathroom and pissed a little on the floor in the seat.
Yeah.
And I really gave it some thought. Should I clean this up?
Yeah.
You know,
you're
or just
leave
like
it?
Preserve it and turn it into a shrine. Marty Allen's would be worth preserving. But
I think so.
But those guys are, there's not that many of those guys left. Like, I'm in Los Angeles now, you know, just 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when I did a signing, Carl Ballantyne joined me in the signing at Skylight Books, and now he's gone. But
like you were saying before, you know, there's this like, you know, the idea, just the fact, the detail of Marty Allen's wig, that there is something, I think what you recognize, and I think as certainly as these people get older, is that there's something horrendously grotesque about show business.
you've noticed that too?
But yeah, but I mean, but it's sort of specific because as things get glossier and, you know, you don't get to see, you don't have that experience, like the way you capture Bob Hope or Milton Berle as they're aging or in different situations where you're taking this icon and making them probably, you know, just as dirty as they really are on some level, that everything's gotten so squeaky clean and so protected that type of show business doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's
and it's
a
part
good
of
point.
The charm. It's part of the charm of it.
That's a good point.
I just saw Larry Storch was you know, he did his last show at the Comedy Store because he started there when it was Ciro's.
Uh-huh.
I didn't see the show, but I saw him after. And there's something like even that place. You go to the Comedy Store?
No.
You never been?
Not for a while.
I mean, it used to be Ciro's.
Yeah,
that used to be the fucking place.
Yeah, I should get over there.
Well, you should just feel it.
Yeah,
I think you'd enjoy the feeling because she hasn't changed it much.
Good point. Yeah, I got to squeeze a lot into this trip, and that's something I'll do.
Yeah, I don't know if you get off on that stuff. I mean, outside of like, you know, drawing these guys, do you get off on old Hollywood?
Oh, I did. You know, when my dad was writing screenplays in the late 60s, he used to bring my brothers and I out, but he would bring us out individually. So he'd always scoop me up and bring me out. And I wanted to get right over to Hollywood Boulevard and just like see whatever is preserved from the past.
Right.
Wherever Ed Wood worked, things like that, you know.
You're fascinated with Ed Wood?
Oh, of course. We're actually doing an interview with Larry Kazurski and Scott Alexander, who wrote the Ed Wood film tomorrow. I'm going to join them for an interview, but they're pals.
What was it about him?
Well, the fact that he had virtually no talent, but he was just obsessed with like proving himself, like, you know, just putting his work out there, even though he had nothing to offer, basically. And I admire that so much. People have nothing to offer, but still they want to offer it, you know. It's like, I think Zero Mostel says, like, all I can offer is failure, you know. People demand success. All I have to offer is failure in producers. And,
yeah.
And I love that line.
How Jewish did you grow up?
Not at all. I didn't go to Hebrew school.
Nothing.
No. We went to bar mitzvahs and seders and stuff, and I used to laugh at all my friends and relatives who had to go through that stuff. But my parents were fallen away Jews, I think.
What screenplays did your old man write?
Well, over the years, he's written... The Heartbreak Kid was based on his short story. Neil Simon wrote that, turned that into the movie.
It's a great movie.
The original, not the new one.
No,
I haven't seen.
The original.
Then he wrote movies like Stir Crazy and Splash. And
did he write Stir Crazy?
Yeah,
that's a good movie.
That's fun. Richard Pryor's great in that.
Yeah,
there's some good stuff on that. He wrote Splash, Dr. Detroit, The Lonely Guy. He
wrote The Lonely Guy?
Yeah, with Steve Martin film. So he had a good run in the 80s.
You know? Grodin was great.
He was.
Yeah.
He was. He was like very subdued. Grodin was actually obsessed with that book, my dad's book, Lonely Guy's Book of Life, which they based the movie on.
Yeah.
He was kind of, he used to read passages from it. So it was great that they got him.
Was he a family friend?
Yeah, he was actually goes back way back with my father because he was in Steam Bath, my father's play, when it was off Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And then he starred in The Heartbreak Kid. So they've had this, you know, over the years, over 50 years now, because he was just in this short film that was made of my dad's, one of my dad's short stories with Michael Cera.
Yeah.
Starred in it and used Charles Grodin as his dad in that.
You get along with your dad?
Yeah, we're great friends. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Always?
Yeah, we've never had any. There's never been any issues. We're pals. Yeah, he's doing. He's 84, and you know he's had some health issues, but you know we get along great.
Now, when you started drawing, like, when did you first start doing panels? I mean, as opposed to just doodling and really focus on, you know, creating comics.
The first panel comic strip we ever did was actually the Andy Griffith piece, which was about, you know, Josh wrote it. Excellent, excellent script. And I drew it. It was the late 70s. I was still going to school of visual arts. My teachers were Harvey Kurtzman, Will Eisner, Art Spiegelman.
So, like, explain to me and to, like, the people that listen. Because, like, I mean, I know there's people that in the world of comics, you know, there's the world that you're from, and then there's also the world of mainstream comics. Other than Stan Lee, it seems like a lot of the guys that you gravitated towards were not underground, but definitely off to the side of Marvel, right?
Well, I grew up, you know, like I said, my dad worked next to Stan Lee, so he'd deposit all these comics into my bedroom every Friday. So there were stacks of that stuff, you know, brand new. And I would hang out at Marvel Comics when I was a little kid, get to meet Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, those guys. And like I said, I wanted to be a mad contributor. But as I got older, I did become obsessed with Robert Crumb. I mean, that's like what he was doing just blew my mind. I had never seen anything like that. It changed my life as far as an artist and my whole perspective.
Was that in the 60s or was it around when it was happening?
I was like way too young to even be looking at that stuff. Right. I was 8 years old. You're supposed to be an adult.
So like that one up there, like that first Zap comic?
Yeah,
maybe?
Sure.
Yeah.
That might have been the first one I was looking at. I actually drew that recently for another book where I discovered Robert Crumb's work. And it blew my mind. It was like, I knew I shouldn't have been looking at it. It was so forbidden. And I was like seeing things. It's like, what? You know, it was like looking at...
That's where I learned where the penis went when you did that thing.
Yeah, he educated us all.
He did.
He did.
It's like, right, that's how it goes in.
You're a little younger than me, but I like was 8 years old in 1969, 68, and looking at this stuff. And like I slipped the comic book into the, you know, pile of stuff my parents were buying. They didn't pay any attention. And I had like amassed a little collection. But he changed my whole perspective about everything. Like finally, all of a sudden, I didn't want to be a mad contributor. I wanted to do underground comics.
Well, what was it exactly that
Yeah, I used to look at his work and think like there must be a bunch of guys named Robert Crumb because he had all these different styles, beautiful styles that, you know, and I would learn later that he just like would draw. He'd never like he'd hardly do pencils. He would just draw with ink onto the paper. It was just all in his mind that he was like, you know,
like
I don't believe in God, but I believe somehow he was like touched by God to like draw like that, like Frank Sinatra sings. It's just like,
well, how's your process different?
Well, I really work hard on penciling. Like I really do a tight pencil before I start painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like really block it out. It's like almost like a map, you know, which I follow when I'm
painting.
And also
your style is very pointillistic.
Well, it used to be. I used to do the little dots. And
no
then,
more?
Well,
I guess not.
Not for a few years. I switched over to watercolor to painting. You know, just I actually got bored with it, the stippling style.
Uh-huh.
I don't even like the word stipple. But I'm not a fan of I was never a fan of it. But I love working with the brush. So, you know, my recent books, including my new book, Heroes of the Comics, is all watercolor. Everything's done with the brush.
But you still have that amazing sensibility. There is a sense of it's very hard, I think, that to do something that reads as realistically, but on some level, because of the way they're framed and the way their body is structured, there is a caricature element to it, right?
Yeah, I've been labeled a caricaturist. I don't think I am. Also,
well,
I'm just artist.
I'm just saying,
it's like there's a slight distortion.
That's it.
But there's a slight. But it's not like, you know, I don't.
No, it's not an extreme distortion, which would imply caricature.
Exactly.
It's a slight distortion.
Right. I don't see a chin and have to exaggerate. I don't look at Jay Leno and say, I got to extend that chin. You know what? I'll make that chin even bigger. You know, that's what a caricature is.
So when you say a slight distortion,
it
happens,
you know,
naturally.
Perhaps you won't even pick it up, and perhaps in some cases there's no distortion,
right?
Like with the Jack Kirby portrait on the cover, I don't think there's any exaggeration. It's what I wanted to capture was that melancholy, like broken down spirit. You know, this guy who created all this work over 50 years.
Who was he?
Well, he like did all the early Marvel superhero stuff. Like he invented, along with Stan Lee's writing, the Fantastic Four and the Hulk and Captain America.
He invented with Stan Lee.
He basically created all that stuff. Like drew all that early work.
Yeah,
and he was not very well compensated, especially later in his life. And they kept all his artwork. They finally returned some of it. He wasn't appreciated. He wasn't treated very nicely, I don't think.
Did he ever get it?
They returned some of his artwork years later, and only recently they worked out a deal. Marvel, who's owned by Disney, they worked out a deal to give his family, you know, some of the money that is due.
Really?
Yeah. or some of the money.
So
they
this
should.
Is like a sort of a beaten man kind of.
It's
kind of
there, but still like reflecting his that amazing universe he created behind him in that swirling Jack Kirby-esque artwork.
Yeah, and do you find that a lot? Of, well, you know, Stan Lee's doing fine.
Yeah, well, he's 91. He still goes to conventions and he's having fun.
Like, you know, I'm sad to say, and maybe I'm alone in this, in that, you know, like my sense of comics, like I didn't grow up loving them, and there was a period maybe when I was in my 30s that I started reading a few, but I came into comics more around the stuff like Any Resemblance and the R. Crumb stuff, but in terms of mainstream comics, I never was that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Mad Magazine, definitely. But like, I don't know who a lot of these people are.
Right. You mentioned Al Jaffe. He's in the book. So we got some of the mad guys in here. These are guys who started in comics, like in the 30s and 40s. So Al Jaffe and Mort Drucker, Harvey Kurtzman are in here.
Yeah.
William
Gaines.
I know all about when I was younger and then kind of moved away from that world. And I kind of lost interest in mainstream comics like as the years. When the comics code came into being.
What is that now?
That's the little code you see, that little box.
Yeah.
They kind of, the comic books became bland after that happened. They got rid of all the horror comics and crime comics and sex. There was no more sex in comics. It all became bland and whitewashed and sanitized. 55. So kind of after that, I sort of lose interest in mainstream comics, and I jump a decade when Robert Crumb showed up, and that's when I get excited.
S. Clay Wilson?
Yeah, those guys, yeah.
Oh, I love that guy.
Yeah, my next book project might be portraits of all those guys, the Zap guys, including S. Clay
Spain.
Wilson. Those guys, or Robert Williams is still around. He's in Los Angeles.
Yeah, he's here.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Yeah, he's good, but he's after you, really, right?
Well, you know, it's like... He's like a Zap guy. He's like one of the original Zap guys.
Oh, well, I guess so. Yeah.
He dates. He's like did that Chrome like that. He
right,
draw
right.
Chrome.
Yeah, from the
Pretty
detailing.
Amazing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But he was one of those like essential those seven guys.
Right.
Who did Zap
and, Spain?
Yeah.
And him.
Victor
and,
Moscoso, Rick Griffin, who died years ago.
Yeah.
He did a lot of poster art.
He did the psychedelic stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What now? Like you were in Lampoon and stuff. I mean, are you a Gahan Wilson fan?
Well, yeah, sure. I love those guys. You know, I like kind of joined Lampoon when it was no longer funny in the mid-'80s.
Right.
That's when I like, you know, started doing work
right.
for them and stuff.
And what about the other guy? What's his name? Rodriguez?
Yeah, Charles Rodriguez.
He's something,
he's
right?
He's terrific. Yeah, great. He's a hero.
Gross.
Yeah. Sam Gross.
Yeah.
Sam Gross is still kicking.
Yeah.
Yeah, all those guys, Bobby London, all the Lampoon guys were like, you know, I idolized those guys. Like I said, I wanted to be a Lampoon contributor after absorbing all that stuff. In the
what
70s.
Was that guy? What was his name? Bodie?
Vaughn Baudet. He died. He died early too, but he's one of these guys. He used to go to comic book conventions back in the 70s, and he would be there, but he looked like a rock star. He had long hair, like, you know, curled. Yeah. It was curled.
He kind of like Mark Bolan almost.
But, yeah, he did look like him. I mean, he had groupies around too.
Yeah.
So it was like the guys I drew in my book, Heroes of the Comics, are like these anonymous looking guys. They look like stockbrokers.
Yeah.
The guys you would never notice.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they got these guys in the 70s look like rock stars. Like,
yeah.
Showing up at conventions with groupies around them, long hair.
What was a comic book convention like in the 70s?
You know, they were like, a big room with all these like versions who were like into buying comic books, and you know, and me, I was like obsessed with EC Comics. I wanted to buy old EC Comics and Underground Comics.
Which one was those? The EC
well, comic? Like Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Early Mad, when Mad was a comic book, it was an EC comic. That was my obsession.
Do you have a collection now?
No, I got rid of them years ago.
Really?
I used to have thousands.
You let them go?
Yeah, I sold them all. I sold a huge pile.
Did you make money?
When Kathy and I married, I was just like, I don't want to like, you know, take this stuff with me everywhere we move. I made $500. I just said, let me just get rid of it all.
Oh, do you regret that?
No, because they were yellowing anyway. They smelled bad. You know, what am I going to do with this stuff? You know, I'd already absorbed them. You know, it's like I went through them and I didn't need them anymore. I'm not an obsessive collector.
Thank God.
I have stuff.
Kathy, thank God. Not an obsessive collector.
No, I have stuff and people send me stuff. They give me stuff, which is wonderful. But I don't seek out anything anymore. But now, I have an amazing collection somehow.
Now, so you say you didn't do like panels or stories until you and your brother started doing it. After college, I mean, you were just drawing, you know, free. You just were just doodling.
I was going to a school of visual arts.
But when did you go? I mean, when you were in high school,
I was always obsessively drawing. Just like Basil Wolverton, I was obsessed with him. He was the guy who drew the insane, like monster faces. It looked like he was drawing like noodles. It's like, you know, it looked like his line was made from a noodle.
Were these in the EC comics?
Sometimes EC, sometimes Med. He did his own comic books.
Uh-huh.
You'd know his work instantly. He did this. a couple of covers of Mad comic books. Uh-huh. You know? So like you'd never forget his work once you see his work.
It's like skeleton showing. And
not
like,
really. Well, not really like grotesque kind of stuff. Well, right. yes, grotesque, but not monsterish. Type.
Right, right.
Not like ghoulish kind of
right.
things. Like cartoony, but Robert Crumb was obsessed with him yeah. early on, and Art yeah. Spiegelman and those guys, and there's books of his work. But he was like,
is he in this book? Your book?
Yes, he is. Yes, he's in there. But guys like him and Harvey Kurtzman, Don Martin, all the Mad guys are my idols. Mort Drucker especially, and Al Jaffe, and Bob, even the lesser Mad guys, you know, I just like would absorb, stare at their work and just, you know. A lot of the times I didn't even read the stuff. I just wanted to look at the artwork. You know,
yeah, yeah.
So obsessed. But Don Martin's sense of humor and Mort Drucker's caricature work and all of it, I was just absorbed by all of it, and I just wanted to be part of it somehow. And so that's that you know, here I am today.
But when you went to college,
well, I was going to art school. I wanted to be a cartoonist, but I didn't know which particular direction to go in.
What'd you learn in art school though? Like you come
not
in,
not much.
You
I was pretty hard to teach. I kind of went in like knowing what I wanted to do, which was like draw, like what I was particularly obsessed with. I picked up on the stipple work, like just like casually. Started where I wasn't a fan of it. I just like it slowed me down because I used to draw really fast.
Yeah,
and that was like a handicap because it was
the stipple work was what the point.
The pointillism really slowed me down. I had to concentrate.
But you chose to do that. For
yeah,
years.
I did. It was like an experiment.
And then it became associated
well, then
it became, with
you. It became like but it was good because it like it's I think it set me apart. It was like, oh, he's the guy who does that kind of work.
Yeah,
and he's you know he's good at it. And there's nobody else really around who does that, especially cartoon humorous work.
Right.
They're stipple artists, but most right. of their work is like kind of boring. It's like drawings of curtains and clouds, and, you know, yeah. tapestry.
So that's an actual.
And I was drawing Tor Johnson's yeah. face and Shemp Howard and Stip in this, you know, meticulous stipple work. But finally, too meticulous, it just slowed me down. Also, the tapping, constant tapping. You know, we had a little apartment on 6th Street in Manhattan when Kathy and I first got together. And I would, you know, have deadlines and I'd be working at 2 a.m, tapping away. And the bed was like 3 feet away and she'd have to get up to go to work. So finally, you know, she had to say something.
It's worse than cocaine.
yeah, it was driving her nuts. It was gonna destroy the relationship or, you know. And I wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that important to me to just get, so I phased it out over a year.
But it was a sort of an odd usage of a technique.
Right.
That
right.
you made your own.
I think so, yeah. And yeah. also, but mainly it did slow me down because I was drawing way too fast and I was like not concentrating enough as much as I should be. I wasn't giving it enough thought, just drawing way too fast.
Who were your teachers over there?
Well, Harvey Kurtzman was one guy. Who was the
How
guy,
old was he then? He was a,
he was actually my age and he was like 56, which, you know.
But he was one of the original Mad guys?
Yeah, he's actually invented Mad.
Uh-huh.
You know, he like conceived Mad, was their first editor. Wrote everything in Mad, the first 24 issues, practically everything.
And what'd you learn from him? He was a hero of yours, really.
He was
right?
a hero, but you know, I loved Harvey Kurtzman. I loved thinking about him and talking about him, but he was not a great teacher. I was not a great student, but he wasn't a great teacher. He was like basically there just to like, you know, kind of hang out with the students and show them stuff.
Yeah.
It was mainly being around him, being in his presence. He was kind of a guru. So any kind of advice he offered, which was seldom.
Yeah.
But anything was just right on the money. And he also recognized who in the class had potential or had talent worth paying attention to.
And who might
go play. So he kind of singled me out, Mark Newgarden as well, my friend Kaz, cartoonist.
I think I have some of his stuff.
Yeah,
he's
terrific. I'll be seeing him later.
Very different than you.
Yeah, and actually Kaz is an old friend, and Kathy's friends with him too. We go back, way back. We didn't like each other at first because he was a Jersey City Lithuanian punk,
yeah.
and I was a privileged Upper West Side Jew.
Yeah.
And we just seemed to have nothing in common, and we kind of circled each other like we didn't like each other.
But what do you call his style? It's sort of a throwback, you're right?
Yeah, yeah. His style is sort of like the next step from like L.Z. Seeger, the guy who created Popeye. He's
right.
He's like the updated Popeye, you know, especially in the 80s and like the... Like the punk era and the new wave comics and stuff. He kind of like took that style and like updated it to, you know.
Yeah.
And his stuff is still terrific and funny. And I think I'm the first guy who ever said to him, like, Kaz, your stuff is really funny. And he never thought about that because he was like more into the artsy kind of.
Right, right.
I was like briefly editing National Lampoon's comic section. I brought him in. I said, you know, and he said, why'd you ask me to do? I said, I think your stuff is really funny. And he had never considered that.
So. It was not his point.
And he acknowledges that.
Yeah.
But, you know.
He saw himself more as an artist.
Yeah, yeah. He was like, but he comics artist. He also loved Robert Crumb.
Right.
He wanted to be a cartoonist and he wanted to do comics just like me. So we had this parallel kind of existence.
And now Will Eisner is like this grand, you know, this mythic presence. And explain to me his importance?
Well, he was a legendary guy in the world of comic books. Although his work
for what reason?
His work in comics was very brief, just a couple of years. But actually, when he was very young, like 20, 21, he started this shop, they call a shop, with another guy 10 years older than them, where they bring in, when comics were exploding, when Superman just happened.
Right.
So Will Eisner had the foresight to think about like opening this shop where hire all these young artists and turn out all this work and completed comic books stories. And he'd hire writers, artists, inkers, and all these like 40 guys crammed in a room creating these comics. And he was like in charge. And we'd block out stuff for them and everything. Was like in charge. But then he gave all that up to concentrate on his character, The Spirit, which he started. And that was done for a newspaper supplement. It was like the first. It was like he broke away from comic books early on. But, you know, he was another guy who was influenced by movies, especially like something like Citizen Kane.
Right.
Where his panel structure was just like so influenced by Orson Welles and what he was saying in the film noir. And his panel breakdowns were beautiful.
Like that long focus business.
And like, the angles and things you would never see in anybody else's work. And he was like there at the beginning with that.
So that was groundbreaking.
So he was, he was a teacher. And he was from the old school. So his class was really structured, unlike Harvey Kurtzman, which was character. So casual. Will's class was really structured, where he would, one particular class would be all about word balloons. And it is, in Will Eisner's mind, it's like how to draw comics the Will Eisner way.
Yeah.
Was like basically his thinking.
But that's not a bad way to learn from.
Well, like he had all these obsessive students around who were like, oh my God, Will Eisner. It's like, and I was there and I just wanted to draw my stuff.
Yeah.
And Will didn't quite, you know, Will and I got along. We had he enjoyed my sense of humor. He didn't quite get what I was drawing. I was working on a comic about Fred Mertz in his class. And I would, you know, sit in the class and just stipple, like, you know. And he'd look and he said, you know, like, Drew, what do you, call me Friedman. Friedman, what are you doing? You're wasting time. Comics are not about William Frawley. They're about this heroes and villains and soup and heroines and sidekicks. Not about Fred Mertz.
Yeah.
He was like baffled by that kind of stuff. And he just didn't, you know, he thought I was throwing away my talent, on stuff like that. Yeah. But I always enjoyed him. He was like a raconteur. He loved to talk about the old days.
That's funny. He was old school.
He was
what are you doing? Who
certainly
cares about Fred Mertz?
And he was old school, but also he was like 60 at the time, which to me, again, sounds really young now, but he wasn't like an old man. He was like 60 when I had him. But he was really old school, like from another era, from the 30s and 40s.
And what was your relationship with Spiegelman?
Well, again, he was another teacher, and also
he taught there too. Jesus! So was this like they had a comic major, cartoonist major?
This was the late 70s. It was Harvey Kurtzman, Will Eisner, and Art Spiegelman were my three teachers during the week. You know, most of the students in the class, they didn't know who they were. It was nothing special. They were just like the teachers, you know. But for me, it was like Mount Rushmore of cartooning.
Right.
Art Spiegelman hadn't created Mouse yet. But he was, I knew him from Underground Comics. He was very intense about teaching comics. And
smoking those camels?
Constant smoking of cigarettes, but also so intense, had such a deep love for comics and the history of comics and stuff that nobody else had appreciated yet. Like history of comics, including like teaching things about, like Leonard Maltin, was the first guy who wrote a Three Stooges bibliography. No film scholar had ever thought about that.
Yeah.
But Art Spiegelman was the first historian or a comics historian or teacher that actually discussed Mad Magazine in the class or Mad Comic
or
books.
Crazy Cat.
Yeah, that stuff. Yeah, especially Crazy Cat and the stuff from the 20s.
And what'd you learn from that?
Well, it's like, you know, I was such a wise guy back when I was a teacher. I didn't want to be bothered with it. I mean, with student, I hardly wanted to be bothered. I wanted to be kind of left alone, do my own thing. But I appreciated, like, his passion for that stuff. And then at the time, he was creating his own magazine, right at that time, 1980, called Raw.
Yeah,
he was looking for young contributors, and he picked specifically me and Mark Newgarden and Kaz to be in the first issue, which was terrific.
What was the other guy's name? Panther?
Gary Panther.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's terrific, too. He used to be in Los Angeles. He's in Brooklyn now.
Yeah.
But he did, like, this amazing, like, punk kind of.
Yeah, it was interesting.
And also did covers of Time Magazine and stuff at the same time.
I think I have a couple of the old Raws up there somewhere.
Yeah.
That was amazing. That was a huge book.
Great. Yeah, it was like large size. It was like Life magazine size comic. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like the next step from Underground Comics, which were kind of like over at that point, 1980.
Why did you and your brother, like, you and your brother did how many books together? Two?
We had two books come out. The first one was Persons Living and Dead with the Shemp cover. The second was called Warts and All with the warts, that embossed warts that you can, you know, that Stevie Wonder could enjoy, you know. And then after that, we kind of, like, drifted apart. He was like, more into, he was a musician. He moved to Dallas. I moved to Pennsylvania. We kind of, also, I wanted to branch out and do work for, I was doing work for Spy Magazine, so I was doing a lot of illustration work.
A good magazine. What happened to that fucking magazine?
You know, it had its time, and then everybody moved on. Like Kurt Anderson moved on to the radio, and Graydon Carter like became editor of some magazine. I forget what it's called.
Do you?
Stuff like that. You know, everybody moved on and got bored with it. Everybody, all the writers moved to Hollywood, either moved to Hollywood or, you know, like, you know, became screenwriters or whatever. So it's like a stepping stone.
Right.
You know? I was happy with it. I even got bored with it finally.
Sure.
But it was like, at one point, it was like, you know, the magazine. You know, you couldn't miss an issue of Spy in the mid 80s, late 80s. I did, you know, I had some fun, although I did stuff like if I, they said, Drew, we have a thing about Michael Milken. I said, okay, that's fine. You got to tell me who Michael Milken is. It's like, you know, because or Lee Atwater. It's like, I don't know who these guys, you know.
Do you have any room for my Milton Berle piece?
I was thinking along that. Like, I could draw, like, the politicians like Reagan, but, like, some of these guys for out of left field. I said, look, I'm fine with it, but you just got to explain to me who these people are, you know.
But then you do, like, you do a portrait, like, I got to buy some of these. You do a portrait, like, I'm doing research now on Norman Lear, and you've got a picture of Nat Hiken, who was very important to Norman Lear.
Yeah.
And you're like this, you know, you're a kid compared to Norman Lear. And, like, where does Nat Hiken play into your mythology?
To me, Nat Hiken was the greatest, this is my opinion, and, you know, I hate these guys. You know, and they make these statements, but to me, he's the greatest genius, comic genius who ever worked in television. He created the Bilko Show for Phil Silvers and Car 54, Where Are You?
Yeah.
Which is, to me, is like a masterpiece. And you know, every episode.
And you did Joey Ross, too, right?
Yeah, well, he's another guy. He's like, you know, this horrible, like, obnoxious burlesque comedian. Nobody else, nobody saw the potential in him as having any kind of career outside of burlesque comedy with strippers and stuff. Nat Hiken recognized it and actually called him in the middle of the night. Joey Ross was in bed with a hooker.
Yeah.
And Nat Hiken called him and said, look, I want you to audition for the Bilko Show. And
yeah.
Joey Ross hung up on him. You know, he thought he was being, you know, they were
being played.
Yeah.
Him.
He was being punked.
Yeah.
But he called him back, and then he wound up on Bilko as Rupert Ritzik, who was the, chef or the, you know, the guy worked. And then they co-starred with Fred Gwynne in Car 54, and he's brilliant, I think. You know, I mean, he could hardly deliver a joke or a line, but he's just such a presence, such a face.
Do you ever read I don't know if you know about, do you know Cliff Nesteroff?
Oh, sure. I'm seeing him tonight, and I did a piece with him.
I just want to make sure you guys know each other.
Oh, sure. He's he fascinates me because he's a really young guy. He's like 30s, early 30s.
Yeah, I started reading his stuff, I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And he was up in Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
And I met him. He used to do shtick. I do stand-up. He used to do stand-up.
Yeah.
But, like, I thought he was going to be this old wizard, you know, and he's just this young, wiry, little nerdy guy.
I know.
Not even Jewish. And he's fascinated.
Go figure. Yeah, I don't know where he comes from. What you know, but
he really captures almost exactly the same thing that you capture as an illustrator, as an artist, the tone of his prose.
He just put on Facebook, Drew and I are kindred spirits.
I believe that.
I don't know where he comes from either. I don't know much about his background. I know he's a young guy. I think I helped him get into this country when he wanted to move to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I wrote a letter on his behalf explaining why, you know, he's a terrific writer. And also he's writing this book on the history of 20th century comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't wait to see.
I hooked him up with the agent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For Grove Press. Right. I think he got the contract after he was on your show.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I find
he should dedicate the book to you, I think.
Well, maybe he will.
I'm saying it.
There was a couple of things that he wrote that just sort of that changed my mind about I just found it, the tone was perfect.
He is. He's great.
And he's a hell of a researcher. He's completely obsessed.
I've helped him with a few interviews, like he did Bill Persky, the Dick Van Dyke, who's a pal of mine from the East Coast. I hooked him up with him. And then I'm in touch with Jerry Lewis. So I talked to Jerry Lewis occasionally, and I said, Jerry, there's this guy, Cliff Nesterhoff, who was doing this book on 20th century comedy. He'd love to interview Cliff Nesterhoff. He couldn't get over that name.
Yeah.
He had to repeat it over.
Drew,
tell him to call me. I'll talk to him.
And you did know? He?
I think Cliff called him, and it was one of those, all right, call me back on Tuesday. I'll talk to you then. And I don't think it ever happened.
So you're close with Jerry Lewis.
You know, Kathleen Freeman, when she talks about Jerry Lewis, people say, like, well, what's he really like? And she goes, well, he's been nice to me.
Right.
And that's my feeling towards Jerry. You know, you hear all these stories and stuff. I don't know what to believe.
Right.
You know, probably they're all true.
Right.
But he's been nice to me. He calls me and goes, Drew, what are you working on? And I said, well, you know, I'll explain. I've drawn him a few times. And you know, he's just like, he called in once and he said, Drew, how do you do what you do? And I said, I can't explain that, Jerry. How do you do what you do? He said, I can't explain, you know. So but I love, because he has no ego around me. It's mm-hmm. like, he doesn't talk about himself, and I only want to talk about him. You know, I love Jerry Lewis.
I think there's a childish sort of weird emotional thing to him. Like, it seems to me like no ego, because you'd think, like, on some level, he's got a tremendous ego. And then on this other level, when I hear people talk about him, it's almost like he's, like, 12.
There's that. I think, you know, he's got a tremendous ego, but I think he thinks about things like, you know, people think I have a large ego. I got to come off like I don't have a large ego. So, you know, he comes off like, sometimes, right. Yeah. If you catch him on a good day, it's like, it's not there.
What other people that you've drawn of that generation, specifically in one of the... or all of the three old Jewish comedian books, did you build a relationship with?
Well, Jerry is one of the first guys who called. And what happened was, when the first book came out, the Fantagraphics sent it out to some of the still living comedians.
Yeah.
So when it came out, I got a call from Mickey Freeman, who was on the Bilko show. He since died. He loved Drew. I loved the book. And Freddie Roman, who was the dean of the Friars,
he's still around.
Yeah, Freddie's around. Sadly, his son Alan Kirschenbaum died.
Horrible.
He became a good friend. We loved Alan.
He's a nice guy.
He was real sweet guy. That was so sad. Freddie's still around. I think he's a little broken by that.
Yeah.
But Freddie called. He loved it. And then the third call was left as a message. Drew, call me back. It's Jerry Lewis, and he left his number twice.
Yeah.
So I said to Kathy, I said, "Oh shit, Jerry's mad." I said, "What did I do? I gave him that stupid expression."
Yeah.
Or I didn't put him on the cover. I put Milton Berle on the cover.
Right.
So I called him back. I got my nerve up and called him back. "Hey Jerry, you got the book?" "Yes, Drew, I got the book." "So what'd you think?" "I loved it."
"Yeah.
Jesus Christ, what a book." So, and then after that, we became friends. He invited us out to the second to the last telethon as his guests. Kathy and I went out to Las Vegas.
How was that?
It was kind of surreal. I think we lasted 15 minutes to watching the show, but it was mostly like watching Richard Belzer sit up there with Jerry's daughter and the whole Lewis clan. And
right.
It was fascinating, that kind of stuff.
Are you friends with Belz?
I've met him over the years. I don't think I'm friends with him, but
he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He is.
But so that's the only guy that you really got to know.
Well,
with Jerry?
Like, actually, since then, you know, we became friends with Larry Storch. He's done some signings with us. He was at a thing we did.
Coming out tonight?
No, I don't think he's. He's not in the greatest shape. Well, he's in good shape, but he's in his 90s, so it's hard for him to travel.
Right.
But we did. I had a Jewish comedian show in New York at the Society of Illustrators earlier in the year, where all the original art was shown, and the opening had Joe Franklin showed up. And Paul Schaefer and Gilbert Gottfried and Robert Klein and Larry Storch and Abe Vigoda was the special guest.
Yeah.
You know, so people were like, and he sat there for an hour posing for photos. So it was, you know, everybody who passed on going to that opening like still regret it.
Uh-huh.
That was the party of the century.
Yeah. Now, who wrote the text for the new book, Heroes of the Comics?
I wrote all the text for that. Yeah, I knew a lot of that stuff over the years. I kind of. From an early age, I became obsessed with learning about those guys who drew those comics and wrote those comics. So I knew a lot of it, but I also like researched a lot, you know, for the new book.
Uh-huh.
So it's all I didn't. It was suggested that I might bring in another writer, but I said no. This has to be from me, my feelings about them. And most of these guys I admire. Some of them I don't. It was suggested also that perhaps the book should be called Heroes and Villains of the Comics. But I said no. I don't want it to be that specific. Let people if there's some villains in the book, I'll let people figure that out. For
Are
themselves.
There?
Well, there's a couple of it's debatable. But this guy Bob Kane, who created Batman.
Yeah.
I'm putting "created" in quotes because it actually was written by a guy named Bill Finger, drawn by a guy named Jerry Robinson. Bob Kane did the early artwork.
Yeah.
Very crude. For the first piece and some of the early stuff, but it was all like he had a whole staff, but they never got credit.
Right.
That was a lot of things with these guys. Most of them never got credit. You know,
right.
They did this work. They were happy to have the work. They weren't looking to make a lot of money, but they went uncredited. A lot of them did. So I'm giving them their due. I think a lot of, you know, just showing what they look like and presenting their life stories.
Yeah.
But some of the other villains might be, Frederick Wortham would be the main guy who was like, he's the last image in the book. And he's the guy who wrote Seduction of the Innocent, which was the book about how comic books are causing juvenile delinquency. And that led to the Comics Code and comic books and EC Comics ending and some of the other
and
books.
And was he a cartoonist?
No, he was actually a psychologist with a lovely record of doing some great work. He operated out of Harlem. In the 20s and 30s, and then all of a sudden he became obsessed with how comic books were harmful for children, and also changed, like, you know, changed a lot of the facts, like changed a lot of his research, where he, like, you know, would just like add things, like, just to make things seem more horrible than they were.
And why'd you include him in the book?
Well, you know, he's like, he was a hero because he had such a profound effect on comic books, finally, like shutting down EC Comics, shutting down Lev Gleason, turning comic books bland. If so, he, you know, in a way, he could be a villain, but to me, he's a hero because he just
spawned you.
It would be hard to do. Yeah, it would be hard to do a book and not include him. And also, it's interesting about him is later in life, as he was an old man, he became obsessed with comic book fanzines and even wrote a book about them, sort of as a penance, maybe, for what he did to comic book. And then showed up at some of the conventions and got booed and never appeared again, which is
interesting.
Fascinating.
So the way you spin it is that, you know, even though he may have been misguided, the action that came from his research was to liberate cartoonists.
Well, in a way, yeah. He kind of, like, you know, I lose interest in mainstream comics after what he was responsible for happened.
So on some comic level, books, he freed you guys.
I think so. And probably other people as well. Like, I wasn't, like, looking to the mainstream for that kind of stuff. And then Robert Crumb came along a few years later.
And what do you use as source material? Because a lot of these guys are dead.
Well, that was tricky because a lot of them, aside from being dead, I didn't want to annoy any relatives.
Right.
Like, I didn't seek out to, like, could you send me photographs of, I made a couple of exceptions, like Bill Gaines' daughter, Wendy, who was like an old family friend. She sent me a couple of photos of her grandfather, Max Gaines, who was Bill Gaines' father. Bill Gaines is the Mad publisher. His dad, Max, was the guy who actually invented comic books in the early 30s. Like, the first guy to figure out, just staple a bunch of newspaper comics into one magazine, and that was a comic book. That hadn't been done yet.
That was
the
him?
The first one who figured that out.
That was Max?
Yeah, Max Gaines. And then later on, he was one of the guys instrumental in Superman and realizing the potential for Superman and Wonder Woman and some of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then he started this company called EC, Educational Comics. It was limped along. It was bland. It was unappealing. It appealed to little children.
Yeah.
Tiny Todd Comics. He died in a boating accident in 1947. He was in his early 50s. And the company fell to the son, William, who was training to be a science chemistry teacher, a high school chemistry.
Right.
He had no interest in comics. And all of a sudden, it was like Citizen Kane, where he all of a sudden this company was his, and said, okay, let me make the best of it. And then it built up from there. He hired Al Feldstein, and little by little it built up.
To Mad Magazine.
Well, it built up like where they would like introduce the horror stuff and the crime.
Right.
And then he gave Harvey Kurtzman free rein to create Mad, and they did these beautiful war comics, like realistic war comics for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And then Mad, and then it just ended like abruptly in 1955, and that was it. And just Mad was left.
And Mad still exists, doesn't it?
Yeah, it still comes out. Yeah.
And some of the guys are still around, right?
Only Al Jaffe.
That's it.
From the original. No, he's not even one of the original guys, but only Al.
But Don Martin's dead. Jack
Davis is retired. Yeah. Mort Drucker's retired.
Yeah.
They're still kicking.
Dave Berg?
Yeah, he died a few years ago. Paul Coker, you might remember him.
Yeah.
He's still around. He still does work for them.
Uh-huh.
Very few. It's mostly new guys. I do work occasionally for them, not too often.
And what do you think about your contemporaries? I'm very impressed with that guy. What's his name? Charles Burns?
Oh, he's terrific. He's one of my favorites. I love Dan Close.
Close is great, yeah.
Chris Ware.
And,
love his stuff.
And Bagg, are you friends with Peter?
Yeah, old friends with Peter Bagg.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
He's a terrific guy.
I liked his stuff, too.
I think Mimi Pond's work is terrific. She has a new graphic novel out. And there's a lot of great stuff. There's some stuff that's not so great, but I don't pay attention. There's so much of it. You got to pick and choose. But Fantagraphics, I think, publishes the best stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I'm biased, but that's my feeling. You know, when they put it out, it's like there's usually something to it.
They're like good curators in a way.
Yeah, yeah, the old stuff, editors. They bring back the old stuff and then introduce like the best of the new stuff, I think.
And now in terms of entertainment, I mean, you know, do you still watch the Three Stooges?
Occasionally, I still appreciate them, mostly on YouTube, I'll put it on. But, you know, people think I'm obsessed with Ed Wood and this stuff and that, but I'm more content with just to be with my wife and our beagle, Darla, Yeah. We adopted a month ago from the local shelter. She was unadoptable, but we adopted her.
But occasionally you poke around. You like you to
get... Yeah, I still mostly on YouTube and stuff or
and
on TV.
Slowly...
But I still poke. Yeah, it still gets me. I still like, you know, I'll have to watch it over and over. Like just the like last week,
yeah.
I watched Mo Howard like slapping Larry in the head. He was aiming for Shemp, but he slapped Larry. First, I died with laughter, and then I just watched it compulsively over like 10 times. Just like it's like poetry. It's like ballet to me.
Like,
I mean, ballet puts me to sleep, but I can watch that, you know,
I watched
like,
the,
over and
the
over.
Two versions of what is it, And Slowly I Turn?
Oh, with Sydney Fields?
Yeah, and then I watched Abbott and Costello do it, too.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful, beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
Well, then you have Joe Besser as Stinky. There's just nothing, you know, it's just sublime. And Joe Besser was not a great stooge, but he was a great Stinky. It's like, you know, like I said about Curly, he's like from another world. It's
yeah.
Like, who comes up with stuff like that?
Yeah, it was. And his whole, the way he, his energy was bizarre.
Right. You're right. And it's like, we watch Abbott and Costello shows occasionally. We have them on DVD and we said, oh, I hope this is a Stinky. You know,
yeah.
You know that feeling.
You don't know them all by now?
I do, but you know, that's the stuff I can watch over and over. I never get sick of it, you know.
And what do you do for, what do you enjoy in current culture? You know, that like is entertaining.
Oh, currents. I don't know. You know, I really do turn towards the past.
Yeah.
I like Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
I do. I have to admit.
Yeah.
I do. But
that's like the opposite of what you're talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly. Whatever you don't expect is what.
Yeah.
But I like really go back to the past. Like we watch TCM, we watch old movies basically. That's it, you know.
Yeah.
Old TV shows. You know, Shout Factory, I do work for them. I did their Marx Brothers DVD, recent, their old Marx Brothers when they got old.
Oh, they put that out?
Yeah, the Marx Brothers on TV, they did, like from the 50s and 60s.
Oh, I got to look at their catalog. And they send me stuff occasionally. They send me a Richard Pryor box, and I think they did the Bob Newhart.
They did the Mel Brooks box.
Yeah, oh, that's
recently.
Right, that's right.
They just came out, yeah, they came out with a complete Bilko.
Yeah,
recently.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. Phil Silvers.
So are you on the advisory board there?
No, but they hire me to do covers for. I did the Ernie Kovacs cover for them.
Yeah,
for the box collection, the recent Marx Brothers on TV collection, and also when they re-released Mel Brooks, the producers. I did the cover for that last year.
Now, so. Do you think that because like it's great that they're. What is the market for that stuff? Do you have any idea? I mean, do you feel like that culturally we've lost something by losing the context of these guys?
I think there's a very limited market, and I think they know that too. But they put out stuff, you know, that they know is going to make, you know, sell like millions of copies. But then they're also compulsive about this stuff, and they'll put out something like Ernie Kovacs or Old Marx Brothers, you know. And even if it sells, like, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't think like, that's the way I feel. I never set out and say what's going to really do well. Like, you know, I would never have done books on old Jewish comedians,
right?
If I was thinking like, what's going to really sell
sure.
well this time,
sure.
Or even old comic book artists, you know, from the past.
Well,
but
I love
never
it.
Never think along those lines, and you know, maybe that's not so smart, but you know, that's the only way I can operate.
But are you a person that thinks that you know something is, you know, that things aren't as good as they used to be, or we've lost something, or
no?
That...
I don't really buy into that.
Yeah,
no, it's like I think things are fine now. You know, it's like, I don't buy it. No, I don't think that way. I think they were great then, and I think they're great now. You know?
Yeah,
like, I have no complaints. You know, I'm enjoying things now. No, I don't look back and like, oh, if only. You know, there were horrible things.
We're
the
new Three Stooges.
Horrible things that happened back then. Who wants to go back to that time?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, it's like, look what was happening down south and whatnot. And
sure,
it's like, you know,
sure.
Or to women, or you know, it's like not a great. Time, but you know, maybe the comedy, but they were originals, they were the guys who invented that stuff.
That's
so
right.
Now you get guys who are kind of like doing it, like, you know, Dumb and Dumber,
yeah, sure.
Part Three is like, yeah. You know, the kind of like,
did you watch his Three Stooges movie? The Farrelly Three Stooges movie?
I watched it only because my pal Craig Bierko is in it.
I
think that's the only reason I watched it. I thought the guy who did Mo was good,
right?
And that's it. I didn't think much of it. You know? I watched the one, remember the one from TV from a few years ago? And
mm-mm.
They did one, a TV version again. Uh-huh. I think the guy who did Mo was good in that one too.
Yeah, Mo's the one to get.
Yeah,
if you're gonna get
two
one.
Guys, they got Mo, but the rest of the guys not so great.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to do those.
But I love watching those, like, you know, the Bud and Lou movie with Buddy Hackett and Harvey Korman. It's
uh-huh.
fascinating how wrong they get it.
Yeah,
and how miscast those guys were.
I didn't see
it's
that.
Like, watch it. Just check that one. I don't know if it's available, but
it's gotta be.
And then the W.C. Fields and Me with Rod Steiger is just so awful. You know?
Yeah,
and Valerie Perrine, who I think gets naked in that.
Yeah,
I think it was in her contract back then. She had to be naked
in any movie.
I think if she was in Mary Poppins, she would have it. She would
She's
be naked.
She's naked in Lenny too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even though it was no reason for her to be naked. So my dad wrote Steam Bath.
And
that was on PBS in the early 70s with Bill Bixby.
Yeah.
And Valerie Perrine is naked in that. So No, I brought that up with Gilbert Gottfried recently. I said, you know, Steam Bath. He goes, oh, that's the one with Valerie Perrine. I said, I knew that was all you're going to remember from that. Mm-hmm.
All right, man. Well, it was great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Mark.
And I like all the books.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Love that guy, man. His brain is on fire. And you should definitely check out the books. You should definitely check out the books. If you're a comic book person, by all means, Heroes of the Comics is all Drew. He did the text as well. Great. Go to WTFpod.com. Check those tour dates. DC is coming up first. The first leg of the tour is coming up fast. DC on the 9th. Philly on the 10th. Both those shows are sold out. Boston at the Wilbur on the 11th, I believe. I think there might be some tickets for the second show in Boston. Definitely tickets for DC. That's a big-ass room. But go to WTFpod.com/calendar and get the links to all the cities, wherever you are. Check it out. Get some justcoffee.coop over there. Get the WTF blend. I get a little on the back end.
Boomer lives!